Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live on this Friday afternoon. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Grateful that you're here with us. Grateful to get to do this again today. And looking forward to lots of great conversation over the next 2 hours. The topic, Catholic answers to Protestant questions. If you are a Catholic who needs some answers to Protestant questions that are raised in your family or at your work or among your friends, you are the perfect person to call. Also, if you are a Protestant brother or sister who's got some questions about the Catholic faith or how it fits with your understanding of the faith, you want to give us a call, you are also the perfect caller, 888-318-7884. We love these discussions. You should not feel I'm Baptist and they're Catholics. And No. We want to have these conversations, and you are doing us a favor by calling. So please feel welcome, and I hope that you'll feel that you'll be respected when you call, 888-318-7884. And who do you go to when you want Catholic answers to Protestant questions? You go to Carlo Broussard. He wrote a couple of books on engaging in this very kind of dialogue, always encouraging of this dialogue. Great apologist. Hello, Carlo.
Hey there, Cy. I don't know if you come to me for these answers, but you go to Catholic Answers. It's a team effort, man.
Oh, yeah, that's a very good point.
One among many.
That's a good point. Yeah, it's a team effort, and I'm the guy that sits in the back of the boat going, stroke, stroke. You all do the work, and I sit back there with my bullhorn.
I don't know about that,
Carlo Broussard here today.
You have moved many hearts and minds in the years that you've been with us at Catholic Answers, my friend. So kudos to you.
Well, thank you, Carlo. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. As you probably know, I'm sad. Carlo's happy. I'm sad because he moved away, but he's happy because he and his family are in the middle of the country there. I just wanted to ask you about where you live now. Will it be easier for you to get to speaking engagements? Because I know you do a ton of speaking engagements, and California is way out yonder.
Yeah. So, for example, last week I was in Tyler, Texas. So I had a 40-minute flight to Dallas, then a 25-minute flight to Tyler from Dallas. It was literally from wheels up to wheels down, 25 minutes. Whereas in San Diego, that would have been 2.5 hours to Dallas and then the 25-minute flight. So I did save some time there. So being centrally located does allow for shorter flights when I'm traveling throughout the country. So that's one among many pluses and goods of being here in the Diocese of Tulsa.
If you want Carlo as a speaker, especially now that he's closer to you, if you live east of the Rockies, just go to CatholicAnswerSpeakers.com, CatholicAnswerSpeakers.com. If that's hard to remember, just send us an email, radio@Catholic.com. We'll get it to where it needs to go. What kind of stuff are you speaking on these days? Are you talking about the new book, The New Relativism, or what kind of talks are you doing?
Yeah, so recently I gave in Tyler, Texas with Stacy Trisankos. I did a talk on pro-life apologetics 101 with 75 teens. So I'm doing some talks in pro-life apologetics. But my book, I've been doing lectures on my book. I was in Steubenville at Franciscan University a few months back giving a talk on my new book, The New Relativism, Unmasking the Philosophy of Today's Woke Moralists. So I'm doing some presentations on that, engaging in that, but also too for the Eucharist. So within this whole Eucharistic revival that's going on throughout the church, I've been booking some events here in the Diocese of Tulsa and also giving presentations on the national stage for Catholic Answers on the Eucharist. And I have a three-talk mission on the Eucharist where I look at the scriptural evidence for the Eucharist, understanding our Lord's words, this is my body, this is my blood, looking at the historical testimony of the Eucharist and the early church fathers, starting with Paul and then going into the post-apostolic age, and then looking at some Eucharistic miracles, both confirmed by the church and some alleged miracles that are pretty darn persuasive. So it's a three-talk mission on the Eucharist. If anybody out there is interested in bringing me out to their parish to do like a parish mission on the Eucharist in order to revive love for Jesus in the Eucharist.
Amen, brother.
And meet the call of the Eucharistic revival, I can sure do that.
CatholicAnswerSpeakers.com, or as I said, if you ever want to get in touch with Carlo, you can just email us, radio@Catholic.com. We'll get it to him or to whoever's doing the scheduling, if that's what you're looking for. CatholicAnswerSpeakers.com. www.catholicmedicine.com. The number here is 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. The topic this hour, Catholic Answers for Protestant Questions. If you're Catholic and you're looking for some answers to help your Protestant friends or family members, or if you're a Protestant brother or sister and like to know what the Catholics think or why the Catholics think the way they do, you are very welcome. 888-318-7884. We'll start out in Nebraska today. And if you're in Nebraska, you're listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Adam in Nebraska, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Hey, guys. So my question, or a question that I've heard from different Protestant friends, is that if grace perfects nature, then why does it seem that in the Eucharist, the nature of bread is destroyed?
Ah, interesting question. To be honest with you, Adam, I've never considered this one before, so I'm going to shoot from the hip here. The first thought that comes to mind is the axiom, or the principle, grace builds on and perfects nature, within our theological tradition applies to how grace works within our soul. So grace, if it's an actual grace where God is offering us a temporary help to enlighten the mind, move the will towards the truth and the good, that's not destroying our nature and the powers of our nature, intellect and will, but rather enhancing those powers to be able to operate in a way that they cannot operate on their own. And if it's sanctifying grace, it's that abiding, habitual quality dwelling in the soul, we call that sanctifying grace, that enables our natural powers, intellect and will, to be able to operate on a supernatural level in a habitual way. That's called habitual grace or sanctifying grace. So you can see there how the axiom grace builds on nature would apply to us and our nature and how grace works within our souls. It doesn't, within the theological tradition, it doesn't apply to the sacraments, because there's grace that's being received in the sacrament for us. And the axiom would apply there of how the grace of the sacrament is being received by us and perfecting our nature. But it wouldn't apply to the sacrament itself. So, for example, in the Eucharist, it's not that there is grace being infused within the bread and thereby destroying bread, and there's grace kind of remaining there. What you have is God acting in an immediate way through the words of consecration in order to perform a semi-miracle, right? Not totally a miracle, because there's no sensible quality here, but changing the very substance and the reality of the bread into the substance and the reality of Jesus's body and blood. So the axiom of grace builds on and perfects nature, I would say, wouldn't apply to the sacrament itself. It would only apply to how grace works within our souls. So I would say it's just a misapplication of the axiom to the sacrament itself, and therefore does not in any way conflict with what we believe about the axiom and what we believe about the sacraments, and in particular, the sacrament of the Holy Eucharist.
What do you think, Adam?
That was really helpful. So if I could summarize back at you a little bit.
All right.
The axiom is more of a moral axiom instead of a sacramental axiom.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. That would map on to how I'm thinking here of how it'll apply to how grace works within us, not necessarily how grace is working in the sacraments, right? Because in the sacrament of the Eucharist, it's not a temporary help given for the sake of enhancing intellect and will, right? It's the divine power operating, bringing about an effect, which is a change in the most radical way. There's no change like it, because you don't have an accidental change, and it's not really the same as a substantial change like we normally experience, like when Fido dies and turns into dust. That's a substantial change. The change of the Eucharist is close to that, but it's over and above it, because there is no underlying thing that remains in the change except only that which appeals to our senses. We call those the accidents, right? So there's a change in substance that's brought about by the divine power in an immediate way. Only the Creator can do that, because only the Creator has access to the inner reality existence of a thing. And so he can change that very existence from one mode of existence to another mode of existence, from bread and wine to Jesus's body and blood. So that's not a destruction of nature. That's simply the creator working with the natures that he creates, right? Because the bread and the wine is created being, which God can change into the very created body and blood of Jesus. And yes, the body and blood, the human nature of Jesus is created, not his divine nature, but the human nature is created, which is subject to the divine power as he wills it.
Adam, I'm going to leave it there, but I'd like to send you, if you'd like, I'd like to send you a copy of Carlo's newest book, The New Relativism, Unmasking the Philosophy of Today's Woke Moralists, just because that was a fascinating conversation and a question I had never heard before. So I want to reward you with a very fine book, but I'd also like to invite you to call back again. We'd love it if you would. Carlo Broussard is our guest today. Catholic Answers to Protestant Questions. If you're a Protestant person, then you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. If you're a Catholic who doesn't know how to answer or would like some help answering a Protestant objection or question regarding the faith, 888-318-7884. That book that I just mentioned, The New Relativism, Unmasking the Philosophy of Today's Woke Moralists, is available right now for 30% off. When you use the promo code WOKE over at shop.catholic.com, you get 30% off. When you use that promo code WOKE, W-O-K-E. I just want to read to you what Noel Maring said. You know, Noel Maring wrote a fantastic book, a very, very popular book about the whole woke phenomenon. And she says this about Carlo and his work. Carlo Broussard does the important and foundational work of refuting wokeism without polemics or ridicule, but with the simple conviction that we are made for truth. In a time of much coercion and confusion, The New Relativism is a clarifying and compelling read. Get it today, 30% off. Use the promo code WOKE at shop.catholic.com.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Church Pop takes a fresh and fun look at the news shaping our world, featuring engaging, inspiring, and informative Catholic social media content. Find it on Snapchat, Instagram, and on the web at churchpop.com. And you can get Church Pop emailed directly to your inbox. Visit EWTN.com and click subscribe. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Carlo Broussard, our guest. Catholic Answers to Protestant Questions this hour. Your call, welcome, 888-318-7884. We were just discussing at the break. You were really impressed with that kind of that challenge that Adam brought.
Yeah, I was. And I wanted to make note of, it's important for our listeners to know that many of our Protestant brothers and sisters, they have reasons for remaining Protestant that are not irrational. They're good reasons when considered in and of themselves without the proper answers to undermine and refute those reasons. But it's good to know that, you know, our Protestant friends, they aren't Protestant just because they're closed-minded or hard-headed or irrational. A lot of Protestants have reasons to justify their Protestantism in the face of Catholicism and Catholic beliefs. And I do a lot of that. I explain a lot of that and try to share a lot of that in my book, Meeting the Protestant Response, to give Protestant apologists a voice for why they remain Protestant in the face of Catholic arguments. Now, granted, I ultimately argue that those responses do not succeed, But it's important for us as Catholics to hear these responses and reasons why they don't accept the Catholic belief, because a lot of times when you first hear them, you're like, wow, that's a pretty good objection.
Yeah.
Like the objection that came from the Protestant friend of Adam who called earlier. So I just wanted to share that with our listeners, and it's important to know that so that we don't become too inordinately triumphalistic, right?
I mean,
we can be proud in our faith and confident, right? But we don't want to be triumphalistic and thinking that all Protestants are dumb or something. So I just wanted to share that.
Well, thanks, Carlo. I'm going to go right back to the phones. But first, I just wanted to welcome Edgar Lujano in here, who people know from he fills in from time to time. He's our podcast kind of manager and producer. He also answers the phones here most days in the studio. And now he's a married man, so I just wanted to bring you in and say congratulations on
your
recent nuptials.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
How long have you been married? How many days have you been married?
It's been 2 weeks and 1 day. Not that anybody's counting.
Congratulations on 2 weeks and 1 day.
Thank you.
It was a fantastic wedding. The mass was beautiful. As I was telling Carlo before, it was the only wedding I've ever been that had both mariachis and a bagpipe player. So it was a true Hibernio-Mexican wedding. It was very Irish and very Mexican.
Well, you also left out the chant, including some Gregorian chants.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Beautiful Gregorian chant. I have to tell you I have a favorite moment of your wedding.
Okay.
The two of you laying a bouquet of flowers at the feet of the Virgin Mary in the Church of Our Lady of the Rosary.
Why is that beautiful?
It was just beautiful.
Okay, I thought you were going to add something else to that.
Oh, you thought I was going to be a smart aleck about it, didn't you?
Yeah,
you thought
yeah,
I was going to be a wise guy. No, I thought that's sincere because she'll help you in your marriage. She'll be there to help you.
Absolutely. And, you know, I love the Ave Maria, but after watching The Batman, the Ave Maria has become more of a funeral song. So I decided to go with the Salve Regina for that.
Oh, the Salve was perfect. Yeah. It was beautifully sung. It was perfect. Yeah. It was just great. So do you recommend it, getting married?
Absolutely, yeah.
The
first, in all of my experience, I would say yes. Go ahead and get married if you haven't. So those
in your
men
15
out there,
days of experience.
Exactly. For those men out there that have been dating their women for who knows how long, it's time for you to put a ring on that finger. Come on, step up.
Well, we got a lot of weddings around here this year.
Yeah, one more.
And Thomas is getting married this weekend. So
tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow. So people can pray for Thomas and his bride, Mrs. Tank Engine, or the soon-to-be Mrs. Tank Engine. But you're such a good, and people know you from the radio because you've fill in hosted for us, but you're such a good and honorable Catholic man. And I just wanted, you know, because it's beautiful to see you get married. It was very moving, the wedding and all that, but I feel like a lot of young people are missing out on this, and maybe you'd would just encourage them.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've realized, especially within the last, 2 weeks, she truly is my better half and is already making me a better person. So I'm much better at taking out the trash now. So
finally,
there's that.
Somebody's making you a better person.
I know.
Sorry you couldn't be there, Carlo, because you were, you know, because you moved away. But it was a beautiful wedding.
Yeah, sorry I missed it, Edgar, but congratulations to you, brother, to you and your beloved wife.
Thanks, Carl. I appreciate that.
I want to ask you about two things at the wedding, because I think that they were traditions from Mexico.
Okay.
But one of them was a lasso.
Mm-hmm.
They lassoed the two of you?
Yep.
What is that about?
It's so the man can't get away. No. It's a Mexican tradition. It's basically two rosaries put together. So it has all the mysteries all the way around on each side. So 20 mysteries on each side, and it's united with the center, the bottom part of the rosary. It's a way of, you know, staying within the mantle of Our Lady, a form of like a physical representation of the unity.
Yeah.
And the other part are the arras. It's
That's the part that I hadn't seen before.
Yeah, I mean, looking it up, translating it, it's the dowry, but it's a beautiful representation. It's 13 coins, and then one of them is usually of a different material. But what you do is the priest blesses them, hands them over to the groom, and the groom he says, "I give you everything that I have, my riches, and all that I have is yours." And then the bride turns around and says the similar prayer, giving it back to the husband. So it's a fully giving of each other.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful. I thought the priest was extremely rude when the two of you came to the altar and he said Beauty and the Beast. I thought that was wrong.
Well, that's...
I thought that was wrong.
We're good friends, so I'll allow it.
All right. Well, congratulations, Edgar. Thanks for coming in and talking about it. And we've missed you. We're glad you're back.
Thanks. Good to be back.
Peace, brother. Bye. Up next, Caleb in Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Caleb, go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I also have a Protestant objection to transubstantiation. So Thomas Aquinas defines the accidence as a trait that can come and go without something losing its identity. But for gluten, that is something that is essential to the bread of the host, which is why there are no gluten-free hosts, only low-gluten hosts. So my question is, if after the transubstantiation, only the accidents remain, and gluten is not one of the accidents, then why do people with gluten intolerances still need special hosts?
Yeah, that's a good question. My thought in response to that is that, you know, Aquinas also explains and articulates how that which does remain in the sacrament after transubstantiation still has effects on the body. And in this unique case, you have effects on the body that's not coming in virtue of the substantial reality of what normally affects the body in that way. So, for example, alcoholic beverages in substance normally intoxicate the person when overly indulged. But in the Holy Eucharist, after transubstantiation, you have an effect that is still brought about by that which remains, the accidents or the appearances of things, the bodily effects, without it being the substantial reality that it is. This is simply a unique case by the divine power where the accidents of the bread and the wine, that which can still affect the body, are preserved in being by the divine power without the underlying substance that is normally there in ordinary circumstances, namely bread and wine. But in this case, there is no underlying substance in which these accidents remain, as St. Thomas Aquinas teaches in this miraculous way. The substance of the body and blood of our Lord are present, but it's not like the body and blood of our Lord now take on the accidents of bread and wine. That would be a false opinion as well. So it is, we can appeal to the mystery card here in saying that in this unique case, there are still bodily effects that the remaining properties of the bread and wine sustained in being by God have, such as intoxication, or in this case, what gluten can cause within us. So affirming the effect of gluten does not necessitate that we affirm the substance of gluten remaining present. And the only reason why we can affirm that, Caleb, is by divine revelation, because this is what our Lord has revealed to us in transubstantiation. Without such divine revelation, it would be absolutely correct that you could not have an effect of gluten without such thing being present there. You could not have the effect of alcohol without the substance of alcohol being present there, in this case, alcoholic wine. The alcoholic beverage of wine. So, but given divine revelation, we can affirm the effect that these things bring about without the substance of those things being there. And that's the mystery of God's plan concerning the sacrament of the Holy Eucharist. So that's what I would say in response to that, at least initially, as I'm thinking through it.
Okay. That will certainly be hard to get my Protestant friends to agree to, yeah. But that's a good answer. Thank you.
Yeah, it's simply an appeal to divine power. I mean, you could appeal to just other miraculous things, like a corpse does not naturally give life, right? You cannot get life from a cadaver. But by divine power, you get life in a cadaver. It's called a resurrection. So too, in the Eucharist, this is at least a miraculous element to it. It's not a full-blown miracle because you don't have the sensible effect of, you know, the appearance changing into human flesh like in Eucharistic miracles. But there's a miraculous element to it, namely that you normally don't get the effect of alcohol and gluten without alcohol and gluten. But in this case, by divine power, you can get the effect of alcohol and gluten without alcohol and gluten. and that's the miraculous element to it. It requires divine power. So if they have a hard time embracing that, well, then they should have a hard time embracing our Lord raising Jairus's daughter, which I don't think they would.
Caleb, no, of course not. Caleb, thanks very much. I want to send you the book, too, The New Relativism, Unmasking the Philosophy of Today's Woke Moralists, Carlo's latest book. If you'd like it, hang on and we'll send it to you. Let's go to Dominic, also in Nebraska. We have not left the state of Nebraska yet today on Catholic Answers Live, which is fine with me. A lot of nice people in Nebraska. Dominic, go ahead with your question.
Hey, thanks, Di. Yeah, let's go to Nebraska.
Wait, what? I don't know what the Huskers, but I don't know what, it's not like Roll Tide, that's Alabama. What do you say for the Huskers?
Let's go Huskers, I guess.
Let's go Huskers. I'll tell you what, I'll say that, but you got to hang on and we'll you ask a question on the other side because the music started playing. Everything from the Cornhusker State today so far, and it's all been fantastic, but you don't have to be there to call 888-318-7884. Want to get right to the core of Christ's saving message? Want a roadmap for living the life Christ calls you to? It's time to look again at the Beatitudes. In his new book, Heart of the Gospel, How the Beatitudes Show Us God's Plan for Happiness, Father Sebastian Walsh demonstrates compellingly how these eight declarations make up the foundation, the essence, and the final goal of Jesus' teaching. Heart of the Gospel illuminates the scriptural passages from which we get the Beatitudes, explains the significance of their wording, their order, and their timing in Jesus's ministry. And it draws out edifying parallels and connections with salvation history and the lives of the saints. Most importantly, Father Walsh offers wise counsel from his own work as a priest and teacher to help you live the Beatitudes in your own life. Order your copy of Heart of the Gospel today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. We kind of left Dominic hanging there in Nebraska, so right back to him we go. It's Catholic Answers to Protestant Questions this hour. 888-31-TRUTH is the number. Dominic, go ahead and give it a try. Your question for Carlo.
Thank you, Si. So I'm a Catholic, and I've had I just don't feel like I've had a definite answer ever on what the church teaches about the death penalty.
All right. Great question, Dominic. So I'm going to recommend a couple of resources to you before I give a brief summary, both of which go into greater detail of what I'm going to say. So I would recommend a book by Dr. Ed Fazer and a co-author, a gentleman that he co-authored it with, By Man Shall His Blood Be Shed, A Catholic Defense of Capital Punishment. So they go into great detail in this issue there. I would also recommend an article by my colleague and good friend Tim Staples here at Catholic Answers, Pope Francis and the Death Penalty, which you can get at timstaples.com. And basically, the bottom line, Dominic, is that the church has always and still does affirm that the death penalty is in principle legitimate. That, let's state it negatively, the church has never and still to this day has not said that the death penalty is in principle intrinsically evil. And thus, the reason why it is always, at all times, and in all cases, wrong. And that is why we should reject it. When the when Pope Francis issued a revision of the Catechism of the Catholic Church in paragraph 2267 in February of 2018, if you read the document in which they issued the revision, the new language being the death penalty is inadmissible because it is an attack on the inviolability and dignity of the person, that must be understood within the context of the rationale that they're giving behind that. One of which is a new understanding emerging of the significance of penal sanctions imposed by the state. And also, it states, the effective systems of detention have been developed which ensure the due protection of citizens. So Pope Francis and the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith then are appealing to historical circumstances that, given our historical circumstances, Pope Francis has judged the death penalty is no longer a good response to the crime. That would imply that there could have been, could be, and could be in the future historical circumstances that would develop to where capital punishment would be a legitimate and good response to a crime that's proportionate to the gravity of that punishment. So, the change in the Catechism of the Catholic Church in saying it is inadmissible is not based on principle, namely capital punishment is intrinsically evil. Rather, it's based on our historical circumstances and conditions that have led to Pope Francis judging to engage in the cap, to use capital punishment in these circumstances in our historical day and age would be an attack against the viability and dignity of the human being. Not that capital punishment itself is an attack against the dignity of the human being, but rather, given our circumstances, to use capital punishment in these circumstances would take on the character of an attack against the dignity of the human being. And I suppose we could draw an analogy to, you know, if a young kid comes up to me wielding a knife, right? Although in principle, lethal self-defense can be justified in some circumstances, in this circumstance, it would not be justified. And if I were to engage in lethal self-defense against a young child wielding a knife at me, well, then that action would be an attack against the dignity of that human being, because the circumstances have determined it so, not the act itself. Similarly, the act of capital punishment, in principle, in and of itself, the church has always approved it to be intrinsically just, not intrinsically evil. But according to Pope Francis, given our historical circumstances, to utilize such an act of punishment, he judges, would be an attack against the dignity and viability of the human being. Hence the change in the catechism is saying it is inadmissible. So this would be an issue where Pope Francis is taking certain principles, moral principles, and applying them in our concrete historical situation. And so that's what I would say with regard to that. There has not been a change in doctrine. This is a change in the application of certain principles surrounding the use of capital punishment, not capital punishment in and of itself. And that's a distinction that Dr. Fazer draws out very clearly in his book, By a Man Shall His Blood Be Shed. And also, Tim Staples draws this out clearly as well in his article that I recommended earlier, Pope Francis and the Death Penalty. So I would recommend those resources to kind of get you on the journey to start studying the issue.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Dominic. Thank you very, very much for the call. Well, finally, we're out of Nebraska and off to New Orleans, Louisiana. Buddy in New Orleans, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Hi, guys. I had a casual dinner a while back with a person that I don't know that very well, but he brought up something that that I feel like is worth repeating because I didn't have a good answer for it. He said he didn't believe in the Bible because Jesus was the Son of God, not the son of Joseph. And so Jesus is not of the house of David. He might be the son of Mary, but he's not the son of Joseph. So he's not of the house of David, like the Bible says he must be. So he uses that as an argument that the Bible is not credible.
Huh. Okay. Well, interesting argument there. But one way that we can respond, buddy, is that Jesus is of the house of David through the lineage of Joseph by way of legal patronage, right? So Joseph, although not Jesus's biological father, is his legal father. And legal fatherhood is sufficient for Jesus to be in the line of David. Now, there are some biblical scholars who will offer an argument to try and suggest that even Mary is of the house of David and a descendant of David. And because Jesus is taking some of the matter of his body from the Blessed Mother, that he would be physically, right, and by virtue of the blood running through his veins coming from Mother Mary, having a lineage from David. But the common stock answer that's good enough is to appeal to the legal fatherhood that Joseph had over Jesus. And by virtue of that legal fatherhood, of being rightfully Jesus's father by according to legal principles and legal law and law, Jesus would be a rightful descendant of David and thus be of the house of David and thereby fulfill all of the prophecies about the Messiah being of the lineage of David. So Joseph's legal fatherhood over Jesus would suffice.
Does that make sense, buddy?
That makes sense. I guess I was so stunned by that I didn't really try to defend that, but it does make sense that from that perspective.
One of the techniques that I've often heard described on this program by apologists who do this for a living is they experience those things too, where someone says something that they have not heard before, and they'll often say, I don't know the answer to that, but I'm going to look it up and I'll come back to you. So just for future reference, that does take some of the pressure off, at least in my case, when I often feel like a deer in the headlights when people say things, and I just tell them, I'm going to have to get back to you on it. But Carlo?
Yeah, you know, one thought occurred to me as you were talking, Si, and this might be helpful for Buddy, is even our Blessed Mother affirms Joseph's real legal fatherhood over Jesus. In Luke 2:48, in the finding of the child Jesus in the temple, Our Lady says, Son, why have you treated us so? Behold, your father and I have been searching for you in great distress. And of course, Our Lady knew that Joseph was not Jesus's biological father, but yet she refers to him as his father, the implication being that she recognizes the legal fatherhood that Joseph has over Jesus by way of adoption.
I think this is pretty common throughout the world too, that the man married to the pregnant woman is the father of the child, legally and morally. This is, no one in the old days, you could never prove for certain the lineage,
right.
But the man married to the woman who's pregnant is the legal and moral father of the child. And I do think that's quite a common principle all around the world throughout human history. We got to take a very quick break. Buddy, thanks for the call. We'll take that break. Be right back with more Catholic Answers for Protestant Questions with Carlo Broussard on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley of the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Hi, I'm Jack Williams, inviting you to Birmingham for the free EWTN Family Celebration. It's Saturday, August 26th. Enjoy talks from your favorite EWTN radio and TV hosts. You can shop at EWTN's religious catalog, attend Holy Mass, and be part of a televised show. There's even a Eucharistic procession through the streets of Birmingham. Go to EWTN.com/family celebration to find out more and to register. I look forward to seeing you there.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We've got Carla Broussard with us both hours today. So if you are a Protestant person with questions about the Catholic faith or maybe challenges regarding the Catholic faith, you're very welcome to call, and we will definitely get to you at some time in the next hour, 888-318-7884. Maybe you're a Catholic person who is looking for an answer to a challenge that you received from a Protestant friend or family member or work colleague or bus driver or teacher. I guess I don't need to list all the possible human relationships where these questions could have come up. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Off to Massachusetts now. John in Massachusetts, listening on 1060 AM. Awful glad you're here, John. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Thank you. I'm a cradle Catholic, and I have a very, very dear friend who's a Protestant. She's in her early 40s, and she's suffered for the past 20 years or more with extreme anxiety every day. And now, her background is when she was a child, she asked to be baptized and receive First Communion in the Catholic Church. But she was not catechized within her family. This is her own doing. In her early 20s, dealing with this anxiety, somebody she knew who was Protestant told her, gave her some prayers to read, and she felt Christ in her life, which I said, wonderful. But she's convinced that she also, well, she also had the opinion that when she was Catholic, only the priest could read the Bible and interpret the Bible for her. And of course, I've told her that's just certainly not the case. But what I'm trying to do now is convince her that a contrite confession might help alleviate a lot of this anxiety that she's experiencing. And I pray for her constantly every day. I'm not getting through, though, because she says, well, Christ, if I have Christ in my heart, so that's all I need to be forgiven. And I said, yes, that is true. God can forgive you all he wants without you going into the confessional booth. But can you help me out with this a little bit to give her the right words to encourage her to go to confession?
Right, John, let me ask you this. Is she rejecting the Catholic Church or not being a Catholic based on the fact that she now experiences Christ outside of the Catholic Church, whereas she didn't feel Christ in the Catholic Church? Or is she just not going to confession but still a Catholic?
I think it's the first. She experienced Christ after she left the Catholic
with the Protestant. Okay, got it. Yeah, so I wasn't experiencing Christ in the Catholic Church. The Protestant pastor came, ministered to me, started going to the Protestant community, felt Christ in my life in the Protestant community, and that's why I'm not Catholic. Okay, so here's one question that you could ask her, John. Should we determine which Christian community we belong to based on feelings? So let's think through that and how we should answer that question. Let's consider if we were to do so. Well, you could kind of turn the table and say, well, friend, whatever her name is, and say, Betty Sue, right? Let's call her Betty Sue. Betty Sue, consider Catholics who feel Christ in their lives. And you can use me as an example. Carlo Broussard of Catholic Answers Live, he loves Jesus, and he feels Jesus's presence in his life. And he has had a great experience of Jesus Christ in the Catholic Church. Does that mean, based on that fact, that the Catholic Church is the true church that Jesus established? Because if we follow her logic, John, We should belong to the Christian community that I feel Christ in. Well, if that's our principle, well, then she should belong to the Catholic Church, because there are a lot of people who feel Christ in the Catholic Church. But of course, that's not a good principle to follow when we're trying to decide and discern which Christian community to belong to. The real question that we should be asking is, which is the true church established by Jesus Christ? That's the question that she should be asking and trying to answer. And whenever you do the historical investigation, you come to the conclusion that the Catholic Church is the church established by Jesus. And ultimately, that's why we should want to be Catholic, because we love Jesus. And once we know that Jesus started the Catholic Church and that's his church, well, we want to be members of it, even in the visible communion of the church, because that's what Jesus wants for us. Now, another path that you could take is say, well, listen, friend, I believe that you have experienced Christ in your life, and in no way are we denying that. We want to rejoice in that with you. But consider this. Don't you think Christ wants you to have not only a feeling of his presence and a relationship with him, but also all of the gifts that he has come to give us? If Jesus has given to us all the gifts in the Catholic Church of truth and life, the purity of truth without error, as taught infallibly by the magisterium of the church, the Pope and the bishops in union with him, the fullness of the means of salvation in the sacraments, his substantial presence in the Eucharist, and all of the graces in the sacraments. If Jesus has given the church all of his gifts, well, then surely you don't want just a me and Jesus kind of relationship. You want all of the great gifts that he's come to give us in the church and the communion that he wills for us to be a part of. So it's important to try to explain in a charitable way to your friend, John, in conversation and saying, hey, look, this is a good personal relationship with Jesus is a good. But what if I were to tell you that there is a way to intensify and enhance that personal relationship with Jesus in a way that can go far beyond what you can imagine? And the answer and the reality is there is a way. It's the Catholic Church. And all of the truth and graces that he gives us in the Catholic Church is ordered to this personal relationship with Jesus and enhancing and intensifying that relationship with Jesus, but not only with Jesus the head, and here's a key, John, but also with all of the other believers in Jesus who are members of his mystical body. And that's the importance of belonging to the church that Jesus established, because he's the one who established it, and out of love for him, we want to belong to his church and to experience all of the gifts, not just some, but all of the gifts that he has revealed to us and has given us for our salvation, which is union with him. And so that's possibly a few approaches that you could take in conversation with your friend. What do you think of that, John? Is that helpful to you?
Yeah, that is. I appreciate those thoughts, and I will approach it that way and see how it goes.
All right. Fantastic.
Thanks, John. Thanks very much. Wow, the lines are really filling up. I'm so grateful for all those calls. It's a good thing we got Carlo for another hour. It's Catholic Answers to Protestant Questions this hour on Catholic Answers Live. And Aaron in Hastings, Michigan is next. Hello again, Aaron. Glad to have you back.
Hey, Si. Thanks. And hey, Carlo. Thanks for taking my call.
All right. You're welcome.
Where besides Maccabees can we find the doctrine of purgatory? Because I know that's a big question for the non-Catholics.
Right. Yeah. So, Aaron, you asked the right question today, because you're going to get a free book, my friend. So I wrote a book on this issue called Purgatory is for Real, Good News About the Afterlife for Those Who Aren't Perfect Yet. And I go through several chapters in giving the biblical evidence in building this biblical case for the Catholic understanding of purgatory, looking to Jesus and his teaching, say in Matthew 12:32 or Matthew 5:25-26, and then St. Paul's teaching in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 11 through 15, those passages would establish a New Testament basis and biblical justification for what we believe as Catholics concerning the doctrine of purgatory. So just very briefly, 1 Corinthians 3:11 through 15, that's a classic text that many theologians have appealed to for showing the reality of purgatory in the biblical text. And that's where St. Paul talks about how some have built on the foundation of Christ. And the works with which one built on the foundation of Christ will be tested on what Paul calls, quote unquote, the day, which in his mind is the day of judgment, which according to Hebrews 9:27 comes after death. That's the state of existence he's talking about, a post-mortem existence after death. And the works of the individual who has built upon the foundation of Christ is going to be tested by fire. And if the works are good, represented by gold, precious stones, and silver, the works are going to abide and the individual receives reward. But if the works are not so good, represented by wood, hay, and straw, those works will be burned up in the fire. And Paul says he, the individual, will suffer loss. So there is a suffering of loss on account of the not so good works, which we know, Aaron, are not mortal sins worthy of sending you to hell, but venial sins. How do we know that? Because Paul just told us that this individual has built on the foundation of Jesus. This is a saved Christian. And furthermore, Paul affirms that these are not mortal sins, but venial sins that the individual is suffering loss on account of, because right there in verse 15, Paul says, although he's going to suffer loss, he shall receive a reward and he shall be saved, but only as through fire, indicating that not only the works go through the fire, but the person to whom the works belong and from whom the works were brought about goes through the fire, and the fire being a symbol for purification. So here we have Paul describing a post-mortem, after-death state of existence that is not hell, because the individual is a saved Christian, building upon the foundation of Jesus and being quote-unquote saved, but only as through fire. But it's not heaven either, because the one whose works are being tested, these works are represented by wood, hay, and straw, not so good works. Well, you can't have any venial sins in heaven, and the individual suffers loss. There's no suffering in heaven. So a postmortem state of existence of a saved Christian that's neither heaven nor hell, where the individual is being purified, represented by fire. What do we call that postmortem state of existence? We call that a state of purgation or purgatory. And so that would be a text that we could appeal to in the New Testament, Aaron, in order to show our Protestant brothers and sisters how the Catholic understanding of the doctrine of purgatory is consistent, not only consistent with, but in various ways being revealed to us here by St. Paul in the scriptural text.
Aaron, does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does.
Oh, very good. I'm so happy. Well, tell you what.
Don't forget to get his address
for
the call screener there. I think Edgar's get his address so we can send him that book, Purgatory is for Real.
Hang on the line, Aaron, and it's going to be just a quick minute, and then Edgar will get to you. I am so happy that the lines are so full because we've got another hour with Carlo of Catholic Answers to Protestant Objections. I'm delighted that we've had some Protestant folks call, but I want anybody who's not Catholic to feel welcome. If you have a Protestant objection, often purgatory is an objection, often Mary is an objection, and I shouldn't just say objection. Maybe you have a question. Maybe you're curious about why is it that Catholics do what they do in regard to, or believe what we believe in regard to purgatory or Mary or justification or the Bible or the bishops or whatever. And I see we've got a bunch of great questions coming up. We'll probably have a couple lines open as we go to the break. So if you're not on the line and you'd like to get your question into Carlo, give us a call, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. As we go to the break, I'll remind you again what I said at the beginning. Carlo's in the middle of the country there, and he'd love to come and speak where you are. If you have a speaking engagement for Carlo about the Eucharist, about relativism, you want him to talk philosophy, theology, morality, whatever you'd like, you can find all of his talks over at CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com. And the new book is out, The New Relativism, Unmasking the Philosophy of Today's Woke Moralists. And it's 30% off right now at shop.catholic.com when you use the promo code WOKE. Just type in that word, WOKE, and you get your 30% off. 888-318-7884, the number. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers to Protestant Questions with Carlo right after this on Catholic Answers Live.